This is CD 2 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 2 titled Context and Conflict.
The basic thrust of the Bhagavad Gita concerns karma yoga. To say, oh, I understand karma yoga, doing service consciously and without attachment and towards God, that's all fine. I do it all the time. That may well be, but if you're really unsure whether in fact you are doing it all the time, it would be useful for you to take on a specific exercise in which you do some task that you wouldn't normally otherwise do and do it specifically as an exercise to stay conscious. Getting out of your own ego melodrama is to do something for someone else. But doing it not in a romantic way, as we'll talk about later, but doing it consciously. I'd like to give at the outset a contextual mention of how the Bhagavad Gita fits into the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata is a huge book which covers a long, long period of history. And at one level, it's a historical study of a kingdoms. At another, it's an incredible symbological study of all human interactions, really, and all human emotions and motivations. It's like an incredible psychology, but it's in the form of a drama. And it's written from a very conscious point of view. So you can read it in the very romantic, melodramatic line, or you can look at its symbology. And right in the middle of it is this dialogue that exists between Krishna and Arjuna. The story itself concerns the kingdom of Bharat, which is a kingdom in northern India. And there were two brothers, Pandu and Dhritarashtra. And Dhritarashtra had been born blind. He was the eldest brother, so Pandu ran the kingdom. He became the king because the older brother was blind and couldn't be the king. And what that blindness represents, every Hindu pundit has had a great time with. You could say it represents the fact that he was so attached to his son, Duryodhana, which you'll meet, or you've met, that his attachment made him blind to the Dharma, or blind to the truth, or blind to the higher wisdom. Or you could say that he was the human body which was blind because it didn't have the higher intellect. Pandu had two wives, Kunti and Madri, and he had 5 children. And of these 5 children, these are the good guys, by the way. Yudhishthira is the oldest, and he's like the embodiment of Dharma. He has one minor failing, is that he likes to play dice, which you will see is what led to the particular predicament we find ourselves in Kurukshetra. Bhima, the second son, is very strong and reckless, and Arjuna, the third, is very pure, noble, chivalrous, heroic. And there are 2 more twins by Madri. Dhritarashtra, the other brother, the blind king, he had 100 children by one wife. Now, you have to face these things in the Mahabharata. I mean, you face them in the Old Testament. There's no problem there about 120-year-old men having lots of children. So things are different at different times. Right? Well, now, Pandu, the son, the brother who was the king, accidentally killed a Brahmin, which is a very bad thing to do. And to atone for this, he retired to the forest to do tapasya, austerities. And he left the kingdom in the care of his blind brother. Now, the children grew up, and Duryodhana, who's the son, he's the head of the Kauravas. He's the head of the bad guys, to keep it clear for you. He is very, very jealous of the oldest son of Pandu, because the oldest son of Pandu is going to take over the kingdom, and he wants it for himself. And so there are hundreds of pages of descriptions of how Duryodhana went about trying to get rid of the Pandavas so that he could get the kingdom. He would invite them all to a huge celebration, and he had a huge palace built for them, but it was made all of flammable material. And during the night when they were all asleep, he set it afire, but they had all been warned by a loyal servant, and they escaped underground, and they went off in the woods, and they were hiding. Okay? This is the Pandavas now. It's the five boys and the mothers. Now, just to give you a little more of the flavor of how the dance works, while they were hiding in a cave in the jungle, they heard about the fact that there was a Swayamvara, meaning a wedding selection ceremony for Draupadi, who was this beautiful, beautiful daughter of a very high king, Draupada, and she couldn't find a suitable mate for herself. So Arjuna got Draupadi for doing a number of other things, but he was clearly the one, and they took her and they went off to the jungle. They were hiding out from Duryodhana, who was the bad guy who was trying to kill them all. And as they came near the cave, they yelled out to their mother, Kunti, "Come out, Ma, see what we have brought today." And she was in the cave, and she just yelled out before she came out. She says, "Whatever it be, share it equally among you all." This is a good thing for a mother to say to five children. So they ended up all being the husbands of Draupadi. Right? She had five husbands. Okay, finally they came out of the jungle and they built a very good kingdom, and Duryodhana was just getting more and more jealous. He was really insanely jealous. And he finally knew that Yudhishthira really liked dice. And so he challenged him in a way that he had to do it from a dharmic point of view to a dice game. And Duryodhana got a crooked dice player to play opposite him. And so they started this dice game, and in the course of the dice game, Yudhishthira lost everything. He lost the kingdom, he lost his brothers into servitude, they sold Draupadi down the river, the whole thing went, right? And what then happened was that Duryodhana was so proud and haughty about what he had done that he brought Draupadi in to strip her in front of the court to shame her. And they went to pull her sari off, but no matter how much they pulled, there was more sari. And they had piles of material all over everywhere, and they just couldn't do it because she was protected by the purity of the Dharma. And of course, Krishna was helping secretly on the side, and we'll come to him in a minute. Well, at any rate, the blind king was so embarrassed by his son's absurdity, the haughty son, that he offered Draupadi three boons, and she said, "Well, let my husbands go. Give them their arms back, and that's all. I don't even want a third boon. They can take care of themselves." And so Duryodhana sucked Yudhishthira into another dice game. And in this dice game, when he lost, they had to go to the jungle for 12 years, the good guy, and do penance. In all of the holy books in India, like in the Ramayana too, Ram has to go off to the jungle for a while. And that's all very good. You'll find you'll want to go to the jungle at a certain point too. And here it happens because you lose a dice game, but you'll see how it works in your life. And they have to go for 12 years, and then on the 13th year, they have to hide, because if they're found by Duryodhana on the 13th year, they got to do another 12 years. So they go out and they do the 12 years, and the 13th year, they become servants of a king in a neighboring kingdom, and they just hide out. And Duryodhana tries everything to find them, and he can't find them. And at the end of the 13th year, they come back and they say, "We want our kingdom." And Duryodhana says, "Tough, I'm keeping it." And he says, I wouldn't even give you enough land to carry the tip of a needle. Okay? That is the predicament we find ourselves in at the time the Bhagavad Gita is about to take place. Okay? That is, Duryodhana has pushed the Pandavas too far. And they have no choice now but to fight. Because unjust injustice has taken over the world. It's taken over the kingdom. And the Dharma now has to assert itself. The good guys have to make a statement. And so, both Arjuna and Duryodhana both go to Krishna, who happens to be God, who's in an avataric form. And we'll talk about avatars as the course goes on. And they ask him for his help. And Krishna says, okay, one of you can have all my armies and all my arms, and the other can have me without any armies or any arms. And Arjuna said, well, I want you without any arms. Because his mind is towards God. He says, all I want is God on my side. And Duryodhana was so pleased. He, being the worldly, a dharmic fellow, he said, well, I'm perfect. I'm very happy. I get all the arms and all the might. So the bad guys have this huge army, and the good guys have a much smaller army. See, and Krishna, whose God is only the charioteer for Arjuna, he's not even wielding a bow. Now, if I may, let me introduce you to Krishna. Krishna is born to Vasudeva and Devaki, and she has a very mean brother. He is so mean that he took his father, who was the king of that kingdom, and he put him in jail so he could take over the kingdom. He did that to his own father. But he had a very soft spot in his heart for his sister, Devaki. So when she married Vasudeva, he put up a big feast. And then he decided to drive the chariot himself to take them to their new home. And on the way, a voice spoke out, and it said, beware, the eighth child of this couple will kill you. And it freaked the brother completely. And he wanted to kill both of them right on the spot. But they begged him not to do it. And so he said, okay, if you will agree to live in jail, right, I'll give you a nice suite in jail, and you've got to give me all your children. Then I won't kill you. So they agreed. And the first seven children they had, he took them away the minute they were born, and he killed them. And the time came for the eighth birth, and they put extra guards on the prison, and everybody was in chains. The wife was in chains, and the husband was in chains, and everybody was in chains. I mean, it was just like, it was like the Bible story, you know, about the prison and the chains. But suddenly the guards fell sleepy, right? And they all fell asleep. And then this baby was born, and as it came out of the womb, it said, it said, take me to Gokul, to Nanda's house, and there you will find a girl child, and you substitute me for that girl child. And Vasudeva said, well, how can I do that? I'm in chains. At that point, the chains dropped off, and the doors opened, so he felt this was a message, and he took the baby, and we're going to talk later a great deal about miracles, and so any of these stuff that you even doubt, hold on. Keep a cynical attitude. And they brought the girl back, and the bad brother came in, and he thought that was the baby, and he grabbed the baby, and he touched its feet, and then it went up into the sky, and as it was going, it said, I was going to kill you, but you touched my feet. Even though you were going to do it to kill me, so I'm going to let you go this time. And she disappeared up into heaven, right? Which left this little boy baby over at this other house. Okay? And the interesting thing about him is that he was blue, okay, in color. And he thrived despite these incredible plots that the bad brother, Kamsa, was developing to try to wipe him out. And he was being raised by this woman, Yasoda, who was the wife of Nanda. And what happened was, as he grew up, there were all these miracles that kept happening, but everybody treated them all as hallucinations. I mean, nobody could believe that they had the avatar of the age sitting there. Like at one point, somebody came in and said, your little boy Govinda's been eating mud. Yasoda said, that's terrible. Come here, Govinda. Open your mouth and let me see. And so Govinda opened his mouth, and she looked in, and she saw the entire universe. Right? Saw all the planets and the stars and everything. Right? And she freaked completely. And then Govinda, out of the compassion of his heart, veiled her eyes with mother love. Okay? So then she only saw her baby again. See, and she forgot what she had seen, and she said, oh, I just, you know, I better lay down. I think I'm going to lay down. He would tend to steal from the rich and give to the poor. And people complained to his mother all the time, or his stepmother, about all of the things he was doing. But he could hardly be punished because he was just so incredibly groovy. And he played a very good flute. And he is perhaps the only avatar we have historically that never cried. He just wasn't a crying avatar. He was laughing, he was active, he was enthusiastic. He was like warm, radiant life itself, which is an incredible concept of God. I mean, you've got to realize this is an aspect of God you're hearing about now, in the same way that Jehovah is. And so wherever he went, all the other cowherd boys loved him as a playmate, and the gopis, the milkmaids, just were drunk with love for him, and they followed him everywhere he went. Well, Kamsa realized after a while who this was. This is his uncle now, the bad guy. So he planned a huge festival, and he invited Krishna to this, and at the festival, there was a huge wrestler who challenged little Krishna, 12-year-old Krishna, to a duel, to a wrestling match. Krishna accepted the challenge, and he killed the wrestler, and then he leapt up on the stands, and he took the uncle and he said, well, your time's come too, and he threw him down and killed him. And then he released the uncle's father from prison and made him king again. But at this point, he had showed his hand, you know. I mean, you couldn't think of him any longer as that little blue boy from down the street who was causing all the trouble because, you know. So he didn't go back to Vrindavan after that, and the whole manifestation changed at that point. And he went and he built Dvarka, another city. And from then on, his role was that of being sort of a kingmaker and a guide and a helper to the leaders of the society. He advised in diplomacy and statecraft, and he helped people in trouble all the time. He lived as a perfect yogi. He was sort of a visitor on earth. He didn't have his own kingdom. He kept giving away everything he had, and he was just helping everyone. Because I probably won't mention it again, what happened to him afterwards, because that brings you up to the point where we meet him talking to Arjuna. After the battle, when all of everybody's practically been killed completely, and all the 100 sons are wiped out, Gandhari, the mother of the 100 sons, is walking through the battlefield lamenting, and she meets Krishna, and she says, you stood by when all this happened, and you let all this slaughter take place. All I can tell you is that in your own family, there is going to be killing within the family, and 36 years from now, you're going to die. You'll be killed. And Krishna said to her, thank you, mother, for helping me find a way out. Okay? In other words, that was the curse that was going to give him the way of getting finished with the incarnation. You just got to keep jumping levels about, oh, that's terrible. No, that's wonderful. You know, you could keep doing that, and you'll notice that all the way through the course. And he ultimately was killed when he lay down to rest during a time of battle, and he was killed by a hunter who mistook him for a deer, because he needed a legitimate cause to drop his body. Okay. And he thanked the hunter and blessed him, and the hunter immediately went to heaven. Okay. All right, the other character in our cast that we have to know anything about is Arjuna. And Arjuna is, he's a Kshatriya, he's a warrior. He's of the warrior caste. He's a prince. He's a very pure, good son. He does his duty perfectly. He's fit to receive all of the higher knowledge, but he hasn't yet received it. He's very pure guy. He's got a lot of discipline. He's very practical. He's very pragmatic. He's very emotional. He's very moral. He's intelligent. He's not a philosopher. He's definitely a man of action, which is very appropriate for this society because we are a very rajasic or active society. And he's very principled. And his karma is good. That is, he's ready to go the next step. See, like you'll notice that in the adverse situation of this battlefield, there's Duryodhana and Arjuna, and all that Duryodhana does is get more and more haughty. No matter how rough the scene gets, he gets more haughty, and he ends up commanding his guru what to look at and commanding all of the elders, and he shows no respect. He's gotten so haughty because he's so uptight. Arjuna, when he gets into this crisis, does an entirely different trip. He turns to God. Okay, the scene is laid, and now we get to the conflict. And the conflict is announced by the conch. Imagine several thousand of those, much larger and more sacred, being blown by God himself also. The marvelous sound of it was heard throughout the three worlds and resounded on all sides. The heavens were shattered by the thunder. The ocean heaved and the whole of creation trembled. The terrific roaring of innumerable battle instruments, so that it was thought that the doom of the universe had come. What then was the state of the faint-hearted? The timid were blown away like dried leaves. Even the god of death was frightened beyond measure. Some beat their arms with violence, shouting with fury so that the elephants could not be restrained. Some even died where they stood. The teeth of brave men chattered, and matchless fighters shook with fear. The terrible and deafening sound of all those martial instruments reverberated so that even the creator was afraid. And the gods exclaimed, "The day of universal destruction will surely come." Now, there are a number of levels of what this conflict is about, and it's your ability to empathize with this predicament in the first chapter that's going to make the rest of the book have any meaning to you at all. Okay. And facing Bhishma, who is the grandfather of the whole scene, he's the father of Pandu and Duryodhana, and Drona, who was the great teacher of all these guys. Krishna said, "See, Arjuna, the armies of the Kurus gathered here on this field of battle." Then Arjuna saw in both armies fathers, grandfathers, sons, grandsons, fathers of wives, uncles, masters, brothers, companions, and friends. When Arjuna thus saw his kinsmen face to face in both lines of battle, he was overcome by grief and despair, and he spoke with a sinking heart, "When I see all my kinsmen, Krishna, who have come here on this field of battle, life goes from my limbs and they sink, and my mouth is sere and dry, a trembling overcomes my body, and my hair shudders in horror. And I see forebodings of evil, Krishna." Now, the predicament that Arjuna faces at this point, and I know it seems like I'm staying around the story, but you'll start to watch how it relates now to our predicament, is that here is somebody about to go to Vietnam to fight the holy war for the United States. But the predicament is he gets a look at the guys he's fighting against. And when he looks at them, he suddenly sees that they're us, not them. And thus his whole identification with his national morality is in conflict with another identification with a moral sense of the brotherhood of man. And that was what the whole issue was around the Vietnam War, which was moral law versus social duty. And that's the first level at which Arjuna is freaking. I've told this story in a number of lectures, but it's worth repeating because it relates to the issue so beautifully. It concerns a discussion I had with my father about these records, Love, Serve, Remember, in which my father said to me, "Why are you selling them so cheap? You're selling six records for $4.50. You could sell those records for, I was in the record store, $15, but at least nine, for goodness sake, right?" I said, "Yeah, Dad, I know, but it only cost us $4.50 to produce them. And we're sending them out by mail order." He said, "How many have you sold?" I said, "Well, about 10,000. He said, "You mean you could have sold nine? Would they not have paid nine?" I said, "Yeah, they would have paid nine. You could have charged nine. You would have had $4.50 times 10,000. Think of all the good you could have done with that $40,000 odd. I said, "Yeah, Dad, but it only costs $4.50 to produce." He says, "Well, what are you, against the profit motive? I mean, are you against capitalism?" You got to understand, my father is a ex-president of a railroad, lawyer, good conservative Boston Republican, who's worked all his life as a householder to earn money for his family. So he said, "I don't understand you at all." And I said to him, "Well, Dad, did you just try a law case for Uncle Henry? He says, yeah. He said, was it a tough case? Yeah, very tough. Did you win it? Yeah, but I'll tell you, I had to spend a lot of time on that damn case. I was at the library and I had to talk to the judge. It was a very difficult case. Boy, I bet you must have charged him a big fee for that. My father charges good-sized fees. Father looked at me as if I was insane. He says, what are you, out of your mind? Of course not. That was Uncle Henry. I said, well, that's my predicament, Dad. If you show me anybody that isn't Uncle Henry, I'll burn him. You know? Well, that's the predicament that Arjun is facing. See? He set up a price of $15 for the record album, but he suddenly is selling in the store, and the first customer that comes in happens to be his brother-in-law. See? His brother-in-law says, you're going to charge me? He says, look, for you, I'll give it to you for four and a half. See? See? Well, that's Arjuna's predicament, in a way. All right? And part of what is precipitating Arjuna's predicament is that the way the battle is done in India, it's very civilized. The elephants fight with the elephants and the, you know. And before the battle, they start at sunrise and they go to sunset and then they stop for the evening, right? And this is the night before the battle is to begin, and he has Krishna drive the chariot between the two armies. He looks and sees the whole thing. And part of what led to the tremendous moral uprising in the Vietnam situation for us was television. Because television was the chariot right in the middle of the two armies, looking and seeing the whole scene. And it made visible to all of us the fact that we were killing other human beings. So it made the them, which is very different when there was a war way away where you went off weeks on a sailboat somewhere to fight a war against them, it made it much easier to think of them as the enemy than if you saw them dying on tape, on television. So in a way, part of why we're gathered in this room is because of standing on that battle line in the issue of social duty and moral law. I remember, for example, when I was teaching introductory psychology at Stanford University in 1955, and there was a social psychology experiment involved that required me as the instructor of the course to get up and announce that everybody was to sign up for an experiment and that the results of this experiment would be go in their records. And that was a lie. And I refused to do it. And I was called into the chairman's office, the chairman of the department, and he said, why won't you do this? He said, you know, for this social psych experiment, we have to have pressure on the people. We'll tell them afterwards. And I said, yes, but if I'm in the role of a teacher with students and I lie to them, how will they know this time I'm lying, but next time I'm not? And it got to be an issue that involved the dean's. And I was about to get thrown out of the university before I even began. I mean, it was my first course. And finally, the compromise that was made, which was my karmic chickening out, which I still have to pay for in some way or other, was that I let the chairman of the department come in and make the announcement. Imagine my boss came in and lied to my students while I stood by, so I didn't have to lie. Right? Because I was concerned with this issue of the social game plus my moral responsibility. And you can, without any difficulty, I'm sure, think of dozens of such situations that each of you is and has been facing. It's the lawyer here who suddenly realizes that he can't lie. It's the judge who suddenly realizes that he's against capital punishment in a state that has capital punishment. What's he going to do? Is he going to give up his judgeship? It's the soldier who can't kill. But Arjuna sees the whole issue in another way, too, which is also something that we are facing, and I think, again, a very personal matter. He sees it as the breakdown of family, ritual, tradition, and tradition in the society. See, you've got to understand that India was under a structure that had been laid out in the Vedas, the holy books, by the rishis, who were the realized beings who laid out this structure, which if it worked in the spirit, would work perfectly. If the spirit left it, it became a horrible mechanical set of rituals and a priest class. And that's what had happened at this point. And part of the Gita turns out to be a revolutionary book, which is designed to shake up the entire Indian cultural system at that point. And it's the predicament when something inside of you happens that makes you go against what has been previously something you wouldn't have even considered going against.
all of the rules. Like, for example, I've talked about or written about in Be Here Now, how after I took psilocybin the first time at Tim Leary's house, during the night I went back to my parents' home in a big snowstorm. And it was 4 a.m. and I decided to shovel snow because I felt like healthy and alive and I was stoned out of my head and there was all this snow. And I felt like a young buck in the tribe and I'd shovel snow. And I started to shovel the snow and my parents appeared at the upstairs window. And they flung open the window and they assumed I was drunk. And they said, "Come in, you goddamn idiot. Nobody shovels snow in the middle of the night." Now there was the Brahmin priest saying, this is the ritual. You do it this way, this way, and this way. This is the way you honor your parents, your teacher, your grandsire, and so on. And I had always listened to that. I was really a good boy the whole trip. That's how I got to be a professor at Harvard. Okay. By always listening to what they said about when you shovel snow. But inside my heart, it was like, you know, it's okay to shovel snow. Isn't that far out? Buoyed up by the drugged out of my cultural, social, adaptive, outer-directed, Reismanized way, I was connected to an inner place that was saying, right on, baby, shovel snow. And right at that moment, I was faced with exactly that same point. And all I did was look at them, smile, wave, and went back to shoveling snow, right? And that was the beginning of a long melodrama of my whole life for the next few years, as I slowly saw myself going further and further from the cultural rituals. And when I got thrown out of Harvard, I remember a press conference in which all of the press people were standing around me looking at me like the fighter who just lost the big fight. You know, I've been fired by Harvard. You know, on the front page of the New York Times, I was now doomed to ignominy. You know, because you never made a comeback after that. Because that was a big institution. That was the priest class, really, of the society. And I sat there seeing them, looking in their faces. I was a little stoned at that point, too. And I sat looking in their faces, and I saw more than I might otherwise see. And what I saw was they had this incredible feeling of pity. Pity. And what I was feeling inside was, whew, boy, am I glad I'm done with that. Now I'm free, far out. Okay? But I thought, you know, I'm the only one that thinks this. And the predicament is that if 99% of the people think one thing and you think another, you are inclined to think you've gone psychotic. Okay? And that, I'm sure, is familiar to many of you. That you find yourself growing up in a certain set of rituals and traditions and cultural expectations of how you cut your hair, how you go to school, what kind of education you get, what you do with it, how you marry, what ceremonies you have, how you live after you're married, when you have children, when you don't, how much you save, when you have life insurance, how much you pay for your car, what kind of a television set you have. And some of you have found yourself in conflict with some of these values. That's the issue that Arjuna is facing. Okay. But what the Gita is about is not really the battle of moral law and social duty, because it's a higher game than that. It's really both of those versus higher consciousness. That's where the real struggle is. That's the awakening struggle. That's the one we're here to talk about. That's the one of coming into the spirit or becoming conscious. You see, all of Arjuna's arguments are what would be called enlightened selfishness. He's a member of a caste. He says, I don't want to screw up the caste. He's a member of the family. He says, I want to protect the family. He says, I don't want to kill my uncles and brothers because look what a jerk I'd look like. How could I live with myself if I did that? That's all his own trip. In other words, his whole moral law is built around Arjuna's model of himself from outside looking in. And most of us, you'll notice, are moving. We're going, when we say, trust your intuition, we're learning how to go from inside out rather than from outside in. That's the transformation we're going through. Okay. But we've all, the way a culture socializes its children, and we are all products of that, is by, all you got to do is teach the child one thing, and that is to get his information from outside in and accept his rewards from outside in and not listen to the inner voice. That's the way you train a child to be a member of a society. So that when the mother says, don't do that, even though in your heart you feel it's right to do it, you don't do it. And if you get good at that, enough at that, you become a success in the society. And if you're not, you're an outcast. Or you're an artist. Now, historically, and you've got to understand that the Gita is a series of levels of description. Historically, every time this higher force, this inner message, this connectedness on the vertical rather than on the horizontal plane has manifested, either in a society like with Christ, or in the individual as in your case, or even in the cosmos, all hell breaks loose. There's always trouble. It's always difficult. It's a hard situation. And so when people talk about the Tao, for example, the harmony and flowing with the Tao in the universe, you've got to understand that at the moment of awakening, you are faced with the paradox that you are leaving one level of flow and you seem to be going against the current of that level in order to get into a deeper harmony. But this is what Arjuna is facing. He's going against the current of every single thing he understood to be right. And it's really easy if all the issues are negative issues. You know, if all the things you're supposed to not do, if only you got to kill the bad guys. Like if I say to you, get rid of stealing, get rid of lying, get rid of cheating. That's all easy. See, we can say, right, we're good guys. That's moral duty, right? But how about get rid of love? Ready for that one? Especially in this course. How about get rid of attachment to family? How about that one? You will notice that a culture and an ego both work full-time to preserve themselves. If you study what your ego is, you will see that it is a gestalt. It's a constellation of thought forms that define your universe. They define who you are and who everybody else is and how it all works. And what has got to happen for you to get into the next level of perception of the universe is you have to extricate yourself from that entire web of thought. That's what meditation's about. But the web of thought is designed to keep you in it. For example, in meditation, you're quieting your mind, you're quieting your mind, you're quieting mind, and then something happens inside you. You get a rush and you say, it's happening to me. See? That's the ego who's rushed around, is being pushed out by breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. See? Because there's no room for much universe, ego, psychology, self-concept with... It's not I'm good breathing in, breathing out. It's just breathing in, breathing out. Right? But suddenly, the ego's very... Believe me, the ego doesn't give up. And the ego turns out to be the Kauravas. That's who Arjuna is about to fight. His own ego he's about to fight. You're struggling against every habitual way you have of thinking of the universe because everyone has you locked in being who you thought you were. I'm somebody that's really getting towards enlightenment, aren't I? Okay. Says the ego. Okay. And right up until the very last whisper, the ego is ready to play its final card all the time. See? You've got to expect and know that the battle is never over until the last vestige of self is gone. Every one of the enemy has to be killed. Every single one. Christ says, he who loves mother or brother more than me cannot follow me. That's what Arjun is faced with. It's the same line. He's faced with race going out the window, family going out the window, kinship going out the window, duty to society and nation going out the window. He's going to wipe out the whole society he's supposedly defending. And for us, things like wealth, that's Christ saying, leave what you have, give it away to the poor, and follow me. And Nathanael went off sad, saying, well, I can't do it. Because at that point, it's better to take what you got sometimes and hold on and come and fight another day. And that's what Arjun is trying to figure out how to do. He's trying to figure out how to escape from the predicament. And that is what many of us would like to do quite often. At least I do. And what usually happens is that you will give up this and that and grab on to that and this. So you give up family, you give up wealth, you give up bloop, 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 and you start to cling to spiritual forms and spiritual leaders. Now, that's a good one. But it's all got to go. Big clearance, all got to go. Anywhere you're clinging is going to cost. You don't have to give it all up at once. That's the philosophy of this course. You give it up as you don't need it so bad anymore. You can use it, but know when you're using it, you're playing with fire, and you're going to give it up. We can use the mala beads. Later they'll just become old beads. And then you'll throw them away. But in the meantime, they may help you wake up a little bit. But what Arjuna is facing is a kind of discipline that he's not used to, because he's used to the very secure discipline that comes from always knowing what's right. And now he's faced with a discipline that Trungpa talks about in his book Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, meaning the discipline to not be attached to any patterns whatsoever. The discipline to not stand anywhere. And that's a very scary discipline. As Don Juan says, the art of a warrior is to balance the terror of being a man with the wonder of being a man. But the terror of standing alone in this situation where you can't cling to this and that, you can't say, well, I know what I got to do because it's obviously right because I've got it here written down. And what I think is so exquisite, for example, about Trungpa as a teacher, is how few things he gives you to hold on to, including his own lifestyle. Right? Because it's just hard to find that in a guru manual. And this is really talking about the bodhisattva, he who is courageous enough to walk the path of the bodhi, of the awakened one. Because the awakened one is one who goes into the marketplace and has no friends and no enemies. He has no reference group, no identification, no self-concept, no models, no clinging, no clinging, no clinging. It's only at that point where the conflict has become real for you. You don't know where to stand to judge what to do next. Only at that point are you open to the possibility of something new happening. And that's why this first chapter has to be where it is. Arjuna really has got to have had been shaken to the very roots for Krishna to be able to say anything to him. Krishna and Arjuna have been hanging out together for a long time. They've been friends for years. It's like I was with my guru for long times, but always it was all so nice that I was so satisfied, but only when things got a little nitty-gritty would I start to get a little scared, and then I'd open to him when he'd confront me with something. For example, the incident when he took me through a whole series of experiences where he kept foiling my rational mind because he put me in the role of, tell it like Arjuna. He said to me, Ram Dass, you are the commander-in-chief. Take all these Westerners back to the place they're living and don't let them come here till 6 o'clock. Well, now you got a clear instruction from God, right? Simple enough. Take everybody back. I said, don't come till 6. I just did my duty. Some of the people go at 4, thinking, who the hell is Ram Dass to tell us what to do? They get there, Maharaji feeds them, loves them, takes care of them. I come leading the troops at 6. He goes into his room, he won't see anybody. The next day he calls me and he says, Ram Dass, you're the commander-in-chief. You let people come at 4. Don't let anybody come till 6. So I took everybody back. I said, don't go till 6. Well, the same people that went the day before figured they'd go again, and some more figured they'd go too, so at least half the people went at 4. Maharaji fed them, loved them, talked to them. We came at 6, leading a diminished ranks. He went into his room, he wouldn't see anybody. And he kept doing this to me, like he kept foiling me and frustrating me, and finally I couldn't stand it anymore. And I said to his eldest Indian devotee, I said, Maharaji isn't being fair. And he said, well, you better tell him yourself. And I said, well, I will. You can hear that place in yourself and in me, you know? I mean, you just push to your limit, like, I just can't take any more of this. I've got to know where it's at. And I come into the room, Maharaji's sitting on his bed, looking at me, his blanket. He looks me all over and he says, Kya? What's the trouble? What is it? I said to him, you know my heart, you know what it is. What do you, you know? He says, what is it? What is it? He's making me tell him. I said, well, Maharaji, you're not, you know, fair. And I give a list of my grievances. Right? Like, I'd like, and then I finish, and I'm sort of like I would do in a reasonable discourse with reasonable people. I expect an explanation, right? And I sit back waiting for the explanation. Right? He looks at me, and he leans forward, and he pulls my beard. He says, Ram Dass is angry. And he bursts out laughing. He's cackling away, right? And then when he finishes laughing, he stops and he just looks at me. Like, okay, it's your move now. You just had my explanation. Now I'm faced with a predicament. I've either got to give up my system or give up my guru. Because he's put it right to me. Which way are you going to go, baby? You know, or get off the pot. Right? And at this point, I'm torn. Am I going to get up and walk out and say, well, if you're not going to play, I'll find a guru who will. I'll find a guru who will suit my model of how God's supposed to be. See? Because I'm only asking for reasonable things. You understand that? All right, you've got to understand that. That's important. I wasn't being unreasonable. Okay? All right. He was being unreasonable. And he didn't even care. Okay? And here I had made this huge investment in this man. My guru, you know. I tell everybody, he turned out to be a fraud. Wrong one. Showed his true hand, not a real guru. I'm trying to characterize for you how, for me, these conflicts manifest in daily life, what it feels like when it happens. You know? So the problem I faced is the problem Arjuna faces, which is the disconfirming of the image of yourself. Because what I had to do was give up the model I had of myself as somebody who was pursuing a reasonable course of action. And that's what Arjuna is facing. He's going to have to give up every ground on which he's been basing his action. And maybe it's easy to give up a whole set of things, even family and all this. But let's go one step further. How about giving up pleasure? How about happiness? You ready for those? I mean, hasn't that been what the whole game's been about? to get maximum pleasure and happiness for yourself as a separate entity. And suddenly there's other things going on in you which is identifying you with something which makes you see pleasure and happiness as just more trips. So that you're in the middle of the sexual exquisitry and you say, right, here we are. It's the horror of the predicament when everything starts to become dead to you. All the joys and sorrows, all the romantic storyline starts to fall apart. I mean, you can't tell me you're not romanticizing your own predicament. Boy, I had a hard day today at Naropa. This is hell, all this conflicting philosophy. I don't know that I'd stand it. Boy, it was hot today. I don't have my living situation straight. Gee, I'm so lonely here. I tried to meditate, but I couldn't. But I'll try tomorrow. I'll get better. I tried to sign up for this thing, but it was full. I got to buy some clothes, but I don't have any money. The food isn't right for me. I'm getting sick. I mean, on and on and on and on. And everybody takes it so seriously. You know, you take it as if we're really people doing real things. Okay? But somewhere inside, you wouldn't be laughing if you didn't hear what I just said. Because someone inside, everybody knows the game is already over, but we just haven't died yet. It's like in the Western when the guy gets shot and he's whirling around, but he won't fall down. That place. And it's scary. Because if you lose all the joie de vivre, if you lose all the rushes, are you going to be fit to participate in everyday life? Really? I mean, are you going to be like other people? You know? Aren't you going to be a misfit? Isn't it going to become weird? I mean, are you going to have to make believe you're happy? Like, you know? Like, I haven't gone to a party in a long time to have fun. Sometimes I go to a party to have fun, you know? And I try. We're having fun now. See? But you meet another being who's working on themselves having fun, see? And you look in the eyes, and the eyes are just empty, see? It's like I can meet Trungpa, and he can be sakied to the gills, see? And I can be stoned to the gills. And we meet and we look in one another's eyes, and I look into his eyes, and they're empty. And all around the form is happening of Trungpa-ism. That isn't who he is. That's merely the dance that's going down. And that's what's so extraordinary about these kinds of teachings that you're being offered. Because to the extent that you get caught in the forms, you miss the essence. And you will find that as you get more identified with your essence, you will be less attached to your forms, and then you will merely perform whatever form is suitable for the situation. It's okay. It's okay. Ha 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 ha, aren't I having fun? To be busy not having fun to get holy? Or be busy trying to have fun to get a rush? And that's what this course is about, is the process of divesting yourself of attachment to form. But the scary thing is, when I develop this deeper space, will I still care? Will I still have human concern? I have a friend, Huey Newton, who's a member of the Panthers, Black Panthers. And Huey said to me, the problem I face, he said, what happened? I'll give you an example. He said, one of my Panther brothers came to see me the other day. And he was very irate over an unfairness that had happened. And he told me about the unfairness, and he got all upset. And I told him, I listened to the whole thing, and I had a suggestion. He was very happy with the suggestion. He went away all cooled out. But I was freaked afterwards. I said, why were you freaked, Huey? He said, because I didn't get upset. He said, I used to get more angry than they got about it. But now what happened was, there was just a place in me listening to it all and seeing what had to be done. He says, I'm afraid I'm blowing my seam. I said, well, he said, what am I going to do now? I said, well, now you're in a position to become the perfect Black Panther, because you'll be a conscious panther. But to notice the things that you've held dear turn to be meaningless. Like, for example, you leave home and you get in the car and you drive away. Like, I have this thing all the time. I come to visit somebody and we have a few days and it gets very drunken love, bhakti, beautiful, bliss scene. Right? Then I get in the car and I drive away. And as I drive down the road, it's a whole new trip for me. The person I left often, I start to get a trail of letters. Oh, I miss you. When are you coming back to Dallas? When are you coming back to Atlanta? Oh, why not come here? So come live in our home, please. Attachment, attachment, attachment. And you know what? There isn't one being in the world I care if I ever see again. Not one. Nobody. Hopefully, most of all, myself. That one I can't get rid of. The final thing that Arjuna is facing is he's facing head-on Shiva. He's facing God in the chaotic, destructive form. He's facing the same thing that Job was facing. He's facing his own predicament of saying, if there is a God, if there is law, if there is meaning to all this in a higher level, how could I have to do this horrible thing? He's facing the fact that you cannot apply reason to understand God's law. And in the Ramayana, the story of Ram, Ram says over and over again, unless you honor Shiva, you cannot come to me. That is, unless you have fully honored, allowed for the existence of chaos, chaos. You cannot go through the door on forms. If you're going to be a preserver of love and beauty, you've got to be able to look at the destruction of love and beauty with wide open eyes and say, right, and that too, and that too. And understand that in nature there is creation, preservation, and destruction. Like, I was at Gorda and in Esalen, at Esalen once, and they gave me a house that came with a cat. And every morning I'd meditate in front of my puja table, and the cat was very affectionate, and the cat, out of its love, would go out and bring all of the animals it was going to eat in and sit between my legs while I meditated. And I would hear the scrunching of the skulls of these little lizards and tiny rabbits and all these little things it would get every day. And there I was, patting the cat first. Then a few minutes later, this vicious, cruel animal would be eating this poor little lizard. And I was sitting meditating, wondering, and I was, what was going through my body was hatred of the cat, every skull crunch, you know, okay, pity for the animal, a love for the cat. It was just doing its nature trip. And I was having a struggle with the forces of nature. And as you struggle with the own decay of your own body, that's part of what you're struggling with. Having met gurus and beings of incredible spiritual powers who could change the physical plane, humanity suffered in Bangladesh, in Biafra, and see them sit there and know that they had the power with thought to change the universe, and they didn't do it. They didn't do it. Why didn't they do it? I used to sit with my guru, and 200 miles away was Bangladesh, where thousands of people were starving. Maharaji kept saying, feed people. And here he had the power. There were all these stories about his powers. He could make food appear, and he could change thoughts and do all that. I mean, the powers of yogis are incredible. And he never even did anything about it. Was it his lack of compassion? Or was it another kind of compassion that I didn't understand? That's what Arjuna is facing. That's what Arjuna is faced with, yes. Because you see, the predicament is that there are levels at which your behaviors are relieving suffering. And you may be relieving suffering in a way that satisfies you, you're relieving suffering. And in the greater warp and woof of things, you may be increasing suffering. And what Arjuna is being faced with is various levels of consciousness about the reality of the situation to understand the meaning of his actions. But at one level, he won't fight in Vietnam. At another level, maybe not fighting in a certain situation may allow other forces to operate more strongly, and you may create more negative karma than if you had fought. It's an attachment to a limited viewpoint of how it is from his own point. It's selfish self-righteousness, if you will. Questions? Question was, how do you reconcile this with love for other human beings, with identifying with the God in everyone? She said, when you're killing another human being, you're killing another God. Well, that's exactly what Arjuna has quite a bit to say about. And if you... In fact, the next lecture, we discuss reincarnation. And when we deal with that, you'll begin to see who, in fact, are you killing? Who do you think you're killing, and who, in fact, are you killing? And it is possible to love another being, and there is no form to that love. There is no act in and of itself that isn't a loving act. Any act could be with love. Like, in sometimes, a parent beats the child out of love. And at other times, they don't feed the child out of love. Sometimes you don't feed somebody out of love, sometimes you do feed them out of love. You can't stretch it to the point of killing or not killing out of love, because you can't yet understand what it is you're killing or what it is you're not killing, and whether or not what you're killing is God or not. Like, who are you looking at in another human being? Is it their separateness, or is it the thing which isn't killable? And is that what love is about? Are there different levels of love? Let me leave these all as questions at the moment. Keep working with them, because that's what the course is going to be talking about. I'm not copping out, I'm just raising the issues for you to reflect on. Yeah. That's a very good question. See, the question she asks is, are we merely replacing one set of thought constructs with another set? Is all Krishna going to offer Arjuna is a good rationalization for wiping out the other guys, wiping out his father-in-law and his teacher and all that? Or is this something more interesting? And that really is the issue that I would talk about as the horizontal and the vertical. That in a horizontal plane, you're substituting one structure for another structure. On the vertical plane, you're really undercutting structures, and what's left starts to become something else. But it's not structure in the same way. In other words, we're not substituting, we're giving conceptual models to get out of other conceptual models. But they're only crutches that you use while your leg is broken. Once you're out of those other conceptual models, you give up these two. As I said before, there's not going to be anywhere to stand. Arjuna's not going to come away with a new set of rules that Krishna said to do this, so I can always do this. Hopefully, if it works, Arjuna's going to come away free. So that in every situation, he's wide open to all of the possibilities of the situation without any model in his head. And the model will come out of the quietness in him to experience the entire existential totality of it all, including all of the laws at all the different levels, and all of the empathy, and all of the intellect, and all of it, and all of it, and all of it. And out of that will come the action. That's the Taoist action. The question is that often you make efforts to change or break certain habits, and it doesn't seem to work. And later the thing falls away by itself. And when do you make efforts and when don't you? You're going to notice, because we're specifically going to deal with this matter of how do you deal with desire states and attachments as the course, it's a big part of this course. The answer, the sum though, is going to be to develop a trust in an intuitive sense of the moment, and that there isn't going to be any secure rule that's going to say, well, under condition 6, do 4. See? You're not going to get away that cheaply. See, that's the stuff that gets calcified, and then you go out and you kill everybody for Christianity. I mean, it gets horrible very quickly. And you're going to be faced with every situation. Am I going to do this sexual thing or am I not? Am I going to eat that pizza or am I not? Am I going to give up this? Am I going to get up this morning to go to meditation or am I not? Each one is going to be a whole new ballgame. And you're not going to have the security of being able to hide in any place. And part of the excitement of the situation is how alive it appears. Because sometimes it pays to take on an attachment directly, head on, because you are centered and deeply enough connected to be able to work with that fire. And other times you go near it and you're just getting burnt to a crisp because it isn't time. Because you're not connected well enough to be able to handle that one, and it's better to go and fight another day. Right? You don't do it all yesterday. It's plenty of time. We've got eternity. Right? So you begin to learn about grading your rate of dealing with your stuff. And often you make a struggle at one moment, and then it seems that it fell flat, but nothing is wasted, it turns out. And then that later will go underground, and you'll notice maybe 4 years later that the whole thing is entirely different. And that what you did 4 years, I notice now, you know, people said, what are the critical turning points in your life thus far? Okay. Like an interviewer, and I say, well, you know. But the thing, the questions become more and more absurd to me as the years have gone by. Because I realized that the things appeared to be critical, but they weren't, because the whole thing was a continuous flow in which things I was doing when I was 10 years old were as much a part of what's happening to me now. The karmic package is a total package.